Welcome to the API Experience. Hi, everyone. Turn on, tune in, drop out. You've joined the API Experience. Great to have you here. It's a sunny day in Vancouver in April, and life is good. Mr. Mike Amundson in Kentucky, I think. How are you doing?
Yes, I am in Kentucky. I was okay. Just in London last week. I'm doing pretty good. The weather here also, it's still April here as well, and it is sunny and breezy. It is a very enjoyable spring day.
I know it's important for our listeners to know the weather conditions that we're
broadcasting from. Yes, always.
It's a key point we have to hit. But the fact that you're in Kentucky, I don't know, these days, maybe that's a little bit of a surprise. You've been doing the traveling, the world travels lately.
Yeah, I this is a busy month. So I was in London last week with Eric Vilda, our colleague from API Days, API Academy. So I was with Eric. We were doing a workshop on API management for developers. We're going to do the same thing in Germany next week. And then the last week of April, I'll be in New York for API Days to talk about my web patterns. So yeah, this is shades of the past. I don't know if I can sustain this. Let's see how this goes.
Yeah, that's quite, it is a big shift, right? I mean, you were, I think you traveled 400 days out of the year before the lockdown.
Something ridiculous like that.
Something crazy.
Somehow. With the crossing of the date line, I think you're probably right.
Yeah, exactly. That's what did it. But now it's resumed a little bit. Yeah, well, hopefully you get some home time, but those are all great events. Great to plug in with the community out there.
They're all super energizing to actually meet people who are working on projects like this, doing the real work. I get to learn from them as I share. So it's always a great experience. It's just whether or not the old frame, the old bones can take it. And that's what we'll have to see.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll make it through, and I'll have the FOMO here. and so say hi to everyone. Now, today's topic, people may have already guessed that we are the guests. We certainly wouldn't leave a guest hanging, but you know, something we talked about, well, we've been talking about this a long time, as people will get from the episode. It's something that you can talk about, you know, for years and years and years, but I just feel like it's an appropriate conversation, something that comes up a lot for me lately and in new contexts. And it's surprising that it's still sort of a new thing, but this idea of composability. I think for us, we've been talking about composability and maybe using different words for it for a long time, but it seems to just be, as opposed to being a fad that fades away, it just seems to always come back in a new and even higher level context. You know, I'm seeing it now in business contexts and as companies are sort of grappling with this digital economy. So we want to actually explore sort of a brief history of composability, sort of to pick it apart, see how it's manifested itself over the years. But it's a pretty broad topic, but we're going to give it a shot. What do you think?
I think that's exactly right. And like you said, composability in its various forms is like a perennial topic. It's an evergreen kind of topic. We always seem to be talking about the nature of it, the importance of it, the challenge of it, the so-called benefit of it. The real question is, are we talking about it over and over again because we haven't really come to a conclusion? Or are we just kind of rehashing what's already there? Or are we coming up on new challenges? Is technology changed? That's what I think is really, I find fascinating about talking about the topic right now.
Yeah, definitely. They think there's something going on there. And that's why we're going to explore this topic. So I won't steal any of the thunder of our discussion, but I will say that, you know, just as to the sort of the history within the history, I wrote a piece for InfoWorld.
Yeah.
It was actually 8 years ago now.
Oof, is it time that flies. Long, yeah. Really? Oh my gosh. Yeah.
which was talking about sort of the that was right at peak microservices hype, right? And we you know, we've even back then, Mike, we were experienced enough to have shared our wisdom on having lived through these things before. The gist of that piece, and we'll include the link in the show notes, is that microservices was so hyped, like many trends before it, and it was really sort of looking back at that time to the service-oriented architecture movement, the SOA movement, 10 years prior, and talking about, like, let's not make the same mistakes again. Let's really think this through. Let's understand why fads come and go, and yet these sort of principles remain. And I feel like you know, rather than write another piece saying that's why we're here, right? Because we're once again we've seen these different forums, and we'll explore all the different ways we've seen composability come into the industry. But I guess maybe, you know, the reason we're talking about it under the banner of composability is because there's been a lot of work, especially I would say by Gartner, around this notion of composable architecture and composable enterprise, and describing what makes a composable enterprise, and definitely, you know, taking it at a more abstract level. But I guess the first thing is, like, is there really a set definition of what composability is?
Yeah, well, I would say only if you get super super general, right? Because I think, I mean, the way I think about it, you know, you can look up in Wikipedia, for example. I did a little trolling before we got started here. Basically, they talk about the notion of components that can be assembled in combinations, that are independently deployable, that are stateless or self-contained or autonomous. We've used that kind of general description for decades. I mean, that's what we were generally talking about in the microservices days, in that piece that you wrote in the microservice architecture book that you and I and Irakli and Ronnie released several years ago. Even before that, you know, the same, there's just the idea of well-structured code before there were lots of APIs. So I think that notion of independently deployable and self-contained is the thread, I think, that I see. That doesn't mean that the fact that you can boil it down to that doesn't mean it's easy to manage or implement, but I think that's sort of the key thread, I think. I mean, you've seen the same space too. What do you think?
I totally agree. Like, if we boil it way down, like sort of at the atomic level of what's common across this idea. So modularity, you know, but then as with everything in our industry, the definitions get taken in different directions. I feel like if we think about composability from a more of a business standpoint, I think that one of the trends that I've seen sort of come out of the business world, and what's interesting about this one is, I think a lot of what we'll talk about is the thread that goes through the technology world and the sort of software engineering world around composability. But I think there is an element of, because composability is something that the big tech companies adopted at the, you know, with the web boom and became the biggest companies in the world and so on.
Sure.
From the outside, business people looking at that pattern started to sort of glom onto this idea of business as a platform, and to say, oh, you know, we need to have either we need a platform business model, which is, I think, more specific than, or we need to turn our business into a platform. And this idea, which I think, that's where I think the Gartner work on composable architecture, they're sort of weaving in that business view of, it's not just about the technology components, like they're central to things, but it's also about that when you modularize, if you want to be composable as a business, you need to tie it back to business capabilities. There needs to be sort of an alignment with the different lines of business in an organization, and which, you know, itself sort of brings in something that I'll now have to add into one of the later sections around domain-driven design, sort of thinking of abstraction as well. So I think there's that element of, it's, you know, is there a difference between composability and modularity? It's almost like composability maybe is a little more opinionated than modularity, in that way that it's sort of trying to get alignment with business capabilities. But again, depends on your definition. I think the main thing that I see is that, you know, as we look at the progression, the fact that composability seems to be going up and up and up the value chain up into the business conversations just is more of a reason to pay attention to it, right? It's not just a sort of programmer's tool. It's really on a pretty broad basis. But with that, you know, it's hard it's hard to even talk about the definitions without getting into this whole evolution of the idea of composability. So I know as we were preparing for this discussion, we were, you know, kind of peeling back and peeling back to look at where it started. And it's pretty early on, right? Like this idea of composability comes pretty early.
Yeah. Most people, when they're talking about this notion of composability or components or modules, whatever, end up talking about David Parnas and his paper from 1972 about the criteria for modularity or modularization or something. I can't quite recall. Basically, the notion of, you know, how do you write programs? And at that point, they were writing mainframe programs. It was a big lift to write a program. They always called them systems at that time. How do you create both flexibility and comprehensibility and still not take forever? I mean, you know, basically, how do you modularize? How do you decide what goes where? So I think Parnas has a lot to do with that from the 70s. And he introduces this notion of making every module based on, you know, design decisions to hide information from others. Actually, there's another paper that Parnas wrote around about the same time. It's usually credited as 71 or also 72, which is basically about information hiding. It's the decision about designers, basically puts it on designers. Only expose the things that are necessary, because one of the lines I think from that other paper is an interface is the assumption that each module makes about the other modules, which I think is a really a fascinating kind of element. So I think it starts with Parnas, at least, you know, the stuff that I see really, really comes up from Parnas. And then I think the other one that comes to mind is Dijkstra's separation of concerns statement. We use that quite a bit. That came like a couple of years later, 74, 75, where basically he's credited with this notion of each thing should focus on its own concerns. What I find fascinating is his original rendering of this notion of separation of concerns was on the designer side, the human side, the programmer side. Let's look at this system with the concern of security and how is it arranged. Let's look at the system with the concern of data management, the concern of efficiency and so on and so forth. So looking at the same piece in lots of ways, but separation of concerns has really become an operative term for this modularity, I think. At least, you know, those are the kinds of things that come to mind from the very early part of the story, right?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I think Parnas is still quite active in the industry, but he's, you know, it's like that's the old news stuff. He's like heavy into the ethics of AI and other really important topics. So that's a whole discussion for another day. Yeah. And exactly. I think, you know, and if you are to look at the history of software engineering, right, and you look at sort of the origins of software architecture, those are always two of the papers that are, you know, front and center of kicking off the whole software architecture movement. So it's like right away.
Yeah. And I think, you're really right in the sense that those are really system level or architectural level thinking. I think also when you get a little bit into the day-to-day, the operational elements, how do you create modules? How do you code them? How do you design those interfaces? Nicholas Wirth with his, you know, Pascal programming language, you know, that really kind of sets the stage. That's from like the 90s, I think. Late 80s, maybe. Pascal was one of the first languages to really come up with the notion of subroutines and methods and functions, and worried about side effects, like designing a programming language that wouldn't have side effects. And then you're really on to Alan Kay. If you're talking about, you know, this notion of constructing a system, Alan Kay's time spent on, you know, object-oriented, message-oriented, message passing, designs really set the stage to give not just architects, but also developers that ability to modularize, to create boundaries, to create interfaces, to try to improve the both the coherence and the flexibility of the code.
Yeah. And I think Kay has that quote around, you know, if we kind of went back, everyone put the focus on objects, but he was talking about, you know, it's really about those messages being passed that were the important part, right?
So, yeah, Kay was very much about the richness of the message, not the richness of the interface, right? It's like there are just a few points of contact using that same Parnas idea about assumptions, but the document itself, the message you passed, was super, super powerful.
Yeah, and so here we are. So what? We made it from the 70s, 80s, 90s. I think something happened in the 90s, like with the web explosion. I mean, we already had seen sort of client-server. We started getting this idea of distributed. But then once computing became a highly distributed, networked thing, this idea of modularity went beyond just object orientation and structuring of monolithic applications, let's say, and we get into this idea of web services and service-oriented architecture. I have to say, this is a big deal for me. This was like, early in my career, I was all about the SOA hype and don't regret it for a second, but
same.
You know, the principles around that were really modularity writ large and composability writ large. Hey, try and, you know, don't do this redundant work. You should be building these encapsulated services that can be reused across an organization, across a distributed landscape. I mean, the idea of web services, again, they sort of converge, because I remember web services really being at the launch of SOAP and so on. It was very focused on exposing to the web, exposing to the outside world, and it sort of got hijacked and brought inside a lot of organizations to say, how can we make our own internal systems composable? And that's where the SOA thing really took off. But I do find it interesting. I think it was Roy Schulte from Gartner who coined that term, service-oriented architecture, in 1996, which for me was like fully 6 years before it really went mainstream and combined. But he's ahead of the curve. He did a lot of writing around that. But you know, we went through that. I think the reason that I had written that article comparing microservices and SOA was that SOA just went through this massive hype bubble where it started out as almost a school of thought, an architectural approach, and then devolved into a cookie cutter, you know, go get an ESB and you're done kind of a thing, which I would very strongly argue that you can use, you know, that sort of, they just kind of move the problem they're trying to solve and centralize the problem as opposed to really making things composable.
As often is the case. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what your experience now, you know, REST, what's interesting as well is when Roy Fielding put out his PhD dissertation, which defined REST in 2000. But for me, it was like 2004, 2005 when it really bubbled up, this people saying, you know what, SOAP and what's going on in that SOA movement, because they were it just so happens that the SOA part is completely different words than in SOAP and in SOA, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But they were seemed to be tightly coupled in the public consciousness, but REST was this alternative. I mean, and what was I late to the game there? Like, what was your, were you on the front lines of the SOAP versus REST wars?
No, I think I was in the same boat. So one of the challenges for Fielding is Fielding actually took a long time to complete his dissertation. He's talked about this a couple of times. So through the 90s, he was looking at the web and how the web was working and trying to figure out what makes it unique. And he's working with a bunch of other software architects, Taylor and others at the time, that had these sort of very big picture views, similar to the Parnases and the Dijkstras and the Kay and so on and so forth. So he had been working through that, but his dissertation, I think, comes out in 2000, 2001. It doesn't really get widely circulated until a few years later. So, you know, it all happens sort of in that same fashion. And I too was focused on this notion of SOA and web services before, and I was, you know, struggling mm-hmm. until I found Fielding's dissertation. Then it was something that was, you know, accessible to me. And I was like, oh, man, that's an approach. That's an idea. So I think you're right in that sense. And I think that was the same for a lot of people in the industry who were trying to keep track of this stuff. It was a very exciting, you know, shall we live in, you know, exciting times kind of period there between the late 90s, early aughts. There was a lot going on. It wasn't just Fielding either, right? There were other people right around the same time frame.
Yeah. And that's what I find, you know, it's usually this combination of worlds that you end up with stuff. So I think like there's a whole thread to be, we've spent lots of time talking about the, you know, the power of APIs and the impact of the, you know, REST in practice and how, you know, that became ubiquitous and all the movements it enabled. But it's another example, though, where Fielding started out really defining an architectural approach, and it ended up being associated with a very specific type of implementation around HTTP and so on. But to your point, so you got like the SOA thing going on with the enterprise architects, and then you have the REST stuff going on the web, I think, and then being sort of borrowed in other places. And then I would say in the sort of agile software architecture community, you've got Eric Evans defining domain-driven design, which is coming up with this whole thinking abstractly about how do you structure software systems when you just like forget about the implementation at the, you know, the strategic domain-driven design, really thinking about business domains and data and so on. And that, you know, that was 2006, I believe. So there's all these things happening in parallel. I thought it was interesting that it was like, it was really the microservice definition from Fowler Lewis that sort of brought all those things together. And I think the reason that it did that is if you go back and read Fowler and Lewis's original Blicky, I think Fowler calls it a Blicky, right? His Blicky post.
Yeah.
That defined microservice architecture. It's almost empirical. Like they're saying, we're not coming up with some theory that we're going to test. We went out to all these companies we were working with, and all of our, you know, a bunch of colleagues that were working with these companies got together at a symposium, I think in Venice. I may have the city on.
It was somewhere in Europe. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And we compared notes. And like, what are all these companies that are high performance companies doing? How do we codify that, or what are the principles around it? So I guess it's no surprise that you would find some that were utilizing domain-driven design and building these small packaged components and distributed architectures and so on. And, you know, I think I always found it interesting as well that at that point, SOA in the industry had sort of burnt out and was sort of a bad word, except if you went to companies like Netflix and Amazon, who were like the ultimate poster children of the SOA movement, or of the microservice movement, who were saying we have a service oriented architecture here. So
yes,
you know, it sort of bound all these things together. But I think that the leap forward there. So it brings all together all the principles around why you'd want to do service-oriented architecture, why you'd want to have a composable architecture. But they start talking about the business alignment thing. This is where I see, you know, one of the things is these services need to be aligned. And I think in that statement, and I don't know, we keep talking about these people who put out stuff and then they sort of change their mind later, but it's too late. You had Alan Kay saying, oh, it wasn't about the objects, it's about the messages.
That's right.
Or you have Fielding saying, I took too long on my dissertation. Yep. But I think here, I have seen some regret. I'm not sure if it's from Lewis or Fowler or both, about the micro part and how that's kind of missing the point. Because once again, we get into this problem where the principles get hijacked by the implementation, and now people tightly, just like they tightly coupled SOA with SOAP or REST with, you know, CRUD on HTTP. They went and coupled it with container-based applications. And again, you can build container-based applications that are not really abiding by the microservice principles.
Right.
This is the API experience, brought to you by Boomi.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's almost a hallmark of an important paradigm shift is when the paradigm gets hijacked in some sort of way, or the paradigm sort of gets dissipated by people who are already sort of already have a vested interest in that kind of thing. But I think you're exactly right. I especially one of the things that really strikes me in this list, right, is Fielding is very much about systems thinking, and he's about components that are separated. Eric Evans is really very much about the programming side. Eric's principles really are about the code that's shared back and forth, inside the same memory space. He has in the original book, he has a little section about web services, but he's really focused on the code itself. Mm-hmm. Whereas Fowler and Lewis, again, go back to that sort of notion about, boundary spaces where you've got, these separated components almost, not by chance and not by choice, but we're focused on things. We have to get these connected. So that's another back and forth, I think.
Yeah.
Focusing on the architecture, focusing on the code, focusing on the architecture, focusing on the code. And I think you're bringing your observation, which I think is really important, is the notion that it gets mature enough and well understood enough in organizations that it starts to leak into the business. We start talking about businesses in similar ways. And I think that's a huge advance in the notion of modularity and composability, and that is serving the business itself.
Yeah, and one thing I find interesting is we may make assumptions around, like I think the term microservices, you just don't see it as, I don't hear it as much as I did, although I guess NVIDIA just announced their application platform for running LLMs, and I think they call it microservices. But you don't hear it as much. I think that I mentioned the business as a platform thing. The language of the business is a little bit different. I feel like, I think composable enterprise as a concept was first, I think 2013, the guy named Jonathan Murray, who was, working, I think he was in the media industry, and he wrote a blog post and did some follow-up sort of fleshing this out, which I would say the concept as described by Gartner is very, very aligned with that. But I think it's really hey, let's put this whole idea of modularity in this way in business terms. But what I find interesting when I'm working with business people who are getting more and more savvy on digital stuff, they're the idea of an API is more tangible to them often than the abstract concepts of composability. But I think when you get down to the sort of the value prop and there's reasons why it's still important to abstract things, because people's definition of APIs are different and so on, and there's lots of ways to compose and modularize things. But yeah, I think that sort of brings us up to present day. But I guess the question is, I mean, we've alluded to this. It keeps we keep having these seemingly stop starts around these movements, but yet it almost comes back in a bigger form. And here we are in the composability world. And I would even argue we're even at, as much as we've been in the API space for a long time, even this notion of APIs and their role in the business continues to grow in importance. But like, why is it such a big deal? Like, is there more to the story than just it's the right way to architect software systems? What's going on?
Yeah. I mean, I would say definitely there is more to it than just correctness or, proper style or whatever. I think you touched on it, and I think Murray probably touched on it as well, is this notion of trying to bring composability past the IT department into other parts of the organization. I mean, one of the things, and Gartner, I think, talks about this, is this notion of what is, when we hit the pandemic, there were certain organizations that seemed to do better than others in adapting. They were a little bit more flexible. They were a little more successful, not just because of the industry they were in, but just because of the way the organization had kind of arranged itself. Or, organizational theory becomes a big part of this. The ability to orchestrate and give autonomy to different parts of the organization, it brings up this notion of modularity, this notion that, you know, we're autonomous, we're self-contained, we can move forward without waiting for some other part of the organization. There's a little less dependency. And maybe even the notion of discovering sort of skills or capabilities. You mentioned capabilities earlier. I think this all started to really solidify or crystallize, depending on the metaphor you want to use, in the last 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And again, this is because of what I do. I'll just drag this all the way back to organizational theory, and that's Conway. So that's the late 60s again. So this notion that the software you get is the communication model your organization has is a kind of reflection of this notion of the value of composable business. If you have a composable culture, if you have a composable business, you're more likely to get composable software. And it's a kind of a push or pull kind of experience. I mean, at least that's what I've seen. And I think we've seen lots of other outgrowths of organizational management to treat parts of the company as more autonomous rather than being command and control from the top down. And I think that is reflected in the software.
Yeah, I think it's a big, that idea of adaptability, agility, being able to sort of work in a highly volatile environment where change is inevitable and frequent, right? I think there's enough proof that it's the right architectural approach to deal with that. But like you said, the organization is got to be aligned to that as well. So yeah, I think, you know, and what's interesting to me when you mention that, like, is that how I think there's a whole space around organizational architecture that's still very early stages. That, I mean, I know there's been organizational design and so on has been around for a long time, but I think the idea of borrowing sort of the lessons of systems thinking and even software architecture and applying that in an organizational context. More to come on that. I think that, like, the team topologies, great book that gets into that idea. But again, it's very setting a very basic parameters around, like, here, hey, this is the type of structure that you can have to have fast flow and deal with frequent change. But there's so much more to be written in that space, I think. So, but that's a good starting point. And they definitely reference Conway's law frequently there. So, but on that idea of systems thinking, you know, I think that whenever people ask me for what's the best book that I should read to understand how to be in the IT space, I always point them to a non-IT book, right? I point them to probably a book that you referred to be, Donella Meadows, Thinking in Systems, a primer, right? Because it's a starting point. And systems thinking is just so fundamental for how, you know, as things are just becoming more and more connected. And the more modularized and more composable we are, the more connected we are. And
I think that's really true. I think as we become more connected, we need to continue to promote our own autonomy, however, at whatever level and whatever space you want to think about it. And there has been a lot of great writing over the last 10 to 20 years about this notion of how technology affects culture and culture affects technology, whose breakfast is being eaten by whom, and so on and so forth, to use another metaphor. I'm just going to put a plug in here. A person who's a great resource for finding these threads and kind of bringing them together is Ruth Malin. You and I both know Ruth pretty well. And Ruth has done a fantastic job of doing the kinds of things you're just talking about, which is finding that common thread. How does culture and business and technology weave in and out? And I think that's a great example. But yes, Thinking in Systems is the book that I grabbed first.
Yeah, completely. And I don't spend as much time on Twitter/X, dare I say it, as I used to, but I definitely enjoy following Ruth's insights that she's sharing on there. So shout out to Ruth. And Ruth also wrote the foreword to Team Topologies. So there you go.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Good point. So yeah, I think, and I remember coming across, there was a Twitter account a few years ago, Architect Thinkery or something like that. Anonymous account. Never, if you're out there,
really,
whoever it is, still don't know who it is, but great, sharing some great resources. There's a book referred on there, The Art of Systems Architecting. Not a title that rolls off the tongue, but it was by Eberhard Rechten, and some great nuggets in there, all sorts of heuristics around systems design. And one of them in there is talking about, you know, the greatest leverage in systems architecting is at the interface. So again, this idea of breaking things down into the components, but it's not so much the components that matter, it's the communication, as Alan Kay had said. Yeah. So lots there. But I think that this idea that, you know, we have a hunch that composable systems are more adaptable. The good news here is this was actually through Gene Kim's podcast, Idealcast. He'd been mentioning Dr. Carlos Baldwin and the work that she was doing at, she wrote a book in 2000 called Design Rules, which was really a study of, the componentization, modularization of computer systems was kind of the case study for it. So her background was in economics, and, you know, she did a lot of study on option value in the economics world, and came into the technology world and started to sort of apply this notion of option value. And, you know, her conclusions in that book were very much around, you know, not only showing that modularization led to higher option value, and, you know, higher option value just is a massive thing when you're dealing in a highly volatile environment. But, you know, sort of showing how to measure that and techniques around that. So that's another good one. But she's continued her work. And I think that's why I think it's such an important business conversation now, right? Like, if we accept that, you know, if the last year of ChatGPT landing and sending everyone spinning, like, there's always going to be these big change events, disruptive events, more and more in the digital space. And how do you prepare to, you know, how can you be ready for those? And I think that the answer that, you know, if you study Baldwin's work and, you know, a growing body of literature around it, like, that's how you do it. You got to be composable, because how do you plan for what's coming when you're never going to know what's coming?
Right. I think that's a big one. It's difficult, especially, I think, for me. You know, I spent so much time as a programmer. You know, one of the things I like about programming is I know what the answer is going to be at the end. You know, it's predictable, it's deterministic. But the truth of it, when you're building larger scale systems and, you know, dealing with the future, you never know what the future is. We kind of get inured to the idea of all the possible things that could intervene. So what you end up building and planning for are autonomy and self, you know, self-sustaining and contained and so on and so forth. And those really become the values of a healthy system of any kind, whether they're mechanical or technological or even biological. Is this notion of, you know, being self-contained and not just stateless, but autonomous, I think, which is really important.
Yeah. You just brought something up that we hadn't mentioned at all. At the end of the day, maybe we're just imitating nature. Right.
That's a whole nother, it's a whole nother show, biological, technological, right? There are some people, you know, you can't use birds to explain how to build an aircraft, but you can take the same abstract principle, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's lots there. I tend to use the biological metaphors quite a bit, but, you know, they have limitations just like everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to handle with care. They can become,
as always,
they can
exactly
become
right.
Disorienting at times, but it's just true. This is the way nature deals with entropy in the universe.
So have we solved composability? Will we not have to talk about it anymore?
We're going to just keep talking about it. In fact, let's face facts. This episode is about sharing, having an open discussion, sharing some of the stuff we've come across that's been helpful. Some of the interesting, you know, things that have come and gone, but stayed here in their own way. It's like maybe composability. Okay, this is the hokey pop culture reference, but composability is like Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? It's like, don't strike it down. It will only come back more powerful.
That's right.
Which we've seen a few times. But I have to drop one more thing, which is that my friend of the show, Stephen Fishman, and we have our book. We have a publication date. We mentioned a few times in the show, our book will be published October 1st. It's called Unbundling the Enterprise. Full with subtitle: Unbundling the Enterprise, APIs, Optionality, and the Science of Happy Accidents. Very much about these principles that we've been talking about. It's even live. You can go see the book cover on Amazon and so on. If you look up Unbundling the Enterprise.
I have looked at some early drafts, there is actually a release date now. Is it this year? It's this year.
Yeah, right? October 1st this year.
All right.
It is currently, I think, in typesetting. We're actually presenting at the Enterprise Technology Leadership Summit. EMEA is a virtual event. That's next week on the Thursday. That's Gene Kim's. It used to be the DevOps Enterprise Summit. Is now the Enterprise Technology Leadership Summit. So we're going to be sharing a fun little presentation, telling it like it's a pirate story. So yeah,
that's
lots to come there, but it's, a lot of what we talked about today is incorporated. There's lots of other stuff about more of the web stuff. But I thought I'd throw it out there because, hey, we're talking about the book club. You got to get it in there.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. That's another one of them. It's excellent. Very, very cool. All right.
Well, so it's always fun. We love our guests. We like having these little chats as well. Hope that everybody enjoyed it, got something out of it. We at least have a reading list that we'll share. This will be a longer show notes than usual as we put all the links in here. But Mike, I just want to say thanks for, it's always a pleasure chatting, and hope you have safe travels over the next couple of weeks.
Thank you very much. And good luck to you next week on the presentation and in the final walkthrough of this book that I'm really looking forward to seeing.
Awesome. Thanks so much. And thank you to all the listeners. Hope you enjoyed this one. It's one of our, we're walking around, we're walking the history book, something we love to do. We always get good feedback. So hope you enjoyed it. And we look forward to bringing you the next API experience. Bye for now.